The city of Paris, the French capital, was believed by the Allied commanders to be defended by a powerful German garrison. The Allies had therefore decided to bypass the city altogether and to continue the main drive east. However, in August 1944, members of the underground French resistance heard that the Allies were rapidly approaching and began to revolt, hoping to overthrow their Nazi oppressors before the Allies arrived. Three French units in the American First Army heard of the Paris uprising and refused to bypass the city. Defying their superiors, they struck out for the capital. The 4th Free French Armored Division fought through the Paris perimeter defenses, and the first tanks entered the city center on the 24th of August. Both the French and the American divisions following behind were greeted by ecstatic crowds, and within a day, the remnants of the German garrison had surrendered. While the Allies had been liberating northern France, a second amphibious invasion had begun assembling in Italian and African ports. The 1st Free French Army and the United States 7th Army planned to invade the south of France and meet up with the main Allied thrust in Normandy. Operation Dragoon began on August the 15th, and by the end of the first day, 94,000 men and 11,000 vehicles had landed on the Côte d'Azur. On September the 12th, 1944, just outside Dijon, the 6th Army Group met up with the right flank of the 12th Army Group, fanning south. The Allies now had a solid front line right through France, opposite the German border. Since the liberation of Paris, the Allied spearheads had continued the main advance towards Germany. In early September, the British 2nd Army drove across the French frontier into Belgium, and one day later, liberated its capital, Brussels. Now, the British were just 100 miles from the Ruhr, Germany's industrial heartland, and the Americans were just 70 miles from the River Rhine. Franklin Roosevelt had been president of the United States since 1932. He was one of the most popular presidents in American history, and in late 1944 faced an unprecedented fourth election. But to his friends and colleagues, it was clear that the 62-year-old Roosevelt had aged severely under the strain of office. He was, in fact, dying, and it took all his strength to concentrate on winning the war quickly and with as few more casualties as possible. With little thought beyond victory, Roosevelt was frustrated by the endless political machinations of both Stalin and Churchill. Nevertheless, one major post-war issue had to be decided. Where would the approaching Russian and Western armies stop? And when hostilities ceased, who would occupy which parts of Germany? At the summits of 1944 and 1945, it would be decided that Berlin, the capital of the Reich, was to be taken by the Russians. The goal of the Western Allies would be to capture Germany's industrial heartland, the Ruhr, lying behind the River Rhine. Tired and ill, Roosevelt would play only a minor role in the Allied negotiations, and many American leaders believed that the British and Russians were already taking advantage of his exhaustion. Roosevelt was under added pressure from his military commanders, who believed that the British held more power in the Allied command structure than the size of their armed forces justified. A rift was growing between the British and Americans that now seriously threatened the very existence of the Western alliance. In the midst of increasing acrimony, Roosevelt tried his utmost to bolster the alliance by careful diplomacy. The president remained convinced that the preservation of the special relationship between Britain and America was the only way to ensure the fastest possible defeat of the Third Reich. Winston Churchill had been Prime Minister of Britain since May 1940 and had led the country when all her allies in Europe had been defeated by the Germans. He had gone on to lead Britain through a massive German bombing campaign and a threatened invasion. Churchill had steadfastly refused to surrender or negotiate with Germany and had launched aggressive campaigns in North Africa and the Balkans before the American entry into the war in 1941. Once the United States had declared war on Germany and had lent its vast industrial and military resources to the defeat of Hitler, Britain's influence on the conduct of the war was inevitably threatened. For more than 2 years, Churchill and his military commanders fought a highly successful campaign to preserve British influence in Allied councils. However, by 1944, there were simply too many differences. One of the most significant was over the alliance with Communist Russia. Winston Churchill was, and always had been, deeply suspicious of Stalin's Soviet Union. Already, the advancing Red Army had liberated countries not formally under communist control. And Churchill believed that Stalin had sinister plans for these nations after the war. He was deeply frustrated by the lack of American support in attempting to limit Soviet ambitions, but Roosevelt would not be swayed by any considerations that could affect how soon the war was won. Churchill understood that there were strong anti-British pressures on Roosevelt, and although determined to limit Russian post-war influence in Europe, he could not press his case too hard with the Americans. There was another equally important constraint on Churchill. Great Britain faced bankruptcy and desperately needed to end the war. As a result, Churchill was reluctantly forced to acknowledge that post-war interests would have to be set aside, and that it would be the Americans who determined how the Allies would fight the last battle in Western Europe. Despite the military setbacks of 1944 on both the Eastern and Western fronts, Adolf Hitler still hoped that he could snatch a last-minute victory. The doubts of military commanders were furiously dismissed as defeatist and traitorous, and Hitler increasingly chose loyalty and fanaticism over military competence. Hitler believed that the alliance formed against Germany was fundamentally an unnatural one, and was sure that the pact between communist Russia and the capitalist West could not possibly last. Hitler also knew of the growing tensions between Britain and America, and did everything in his power to drive a wedge between the Allies. The Führer believed that to destroy the Western alliance, the Wehrmacht and Luftwaffe had to inflict such terrible casualties on the Americans in particular that they would become too demoralized to fight on. The British would be unable to win victory alone and would be forced to come to terms. With the war in the West over, Hitler could then transfer all his forces to the Eastern Front and defeat the Red Army. To this end, Hitler ordered his Wehrmacht to hold firm at all costs. They were never to give ground, and they were never to surrender.
One night, Bill had a dream. In this dream, he saw little green men landing their flying saucers on the White House lawn.
The Allied strategy for the final invasion of Germany had been drawn up before the Normandy landings had begun. Senior army commanders, hoping to win the war with as few more casualties as possible, believed that Berlin had no military benefits which could justify an extra 200-mile advance. In any case, the Allied hope was that the occupation or complete destruction of the industrial Ruhr would, by itself, prevent the Germans from fighting on, and so end the war before the year was out. On the way to the Ruhr, the Allies would be faced by a series of rivers and canals, formidable natural obstacles. By far the greatest was the River Rhine, symbolic frontier of the German homeland. Many Allied commanders hoped that the mere act of crossing the Reich's last barrier would result in a complete breakdown in German morale. Resistance, they believed, would crumble away and a quick victory would be achieved. Allied spearheads had already proved themselves capable of advancing more than 75 miles a day. And by early September 1944, the Rhine lay just 70 miles from the front. The Allied advance through France had been much more rapid than the planners had anticipated. And as the supply lines were now stretched to the very limit, several generals had drawn up alternative strategies for the invasion of Germany. These new plans would not only better utilize the overstretched Allied resources, but keep the initiative against the retreating German armies, preventing them drawing breath and mounting a coordinated defense. The original Allied plan for breaking into Germany would utilize three massive army groups with American, British, Free French and Canadian armies drawn up along a continuous line opposite the German border. The armies would first have to secure the great port of Antwerp and be completely resupplied from Britain. When fully up to strength, the Allies would advance on a broad front behind two main thrusts towards the River Rhine. Once the west of the Rhine had been cleared completely of all German resistance, the Allies would mount a crossing at numerous points along the river. Once the Rhine was finally breached, the defenseless Ruhr industry could be encircled, quickly occupied, and the war brought to a rapid conclusion. The new proposals, instead of a broad front advance, called for just one narrow thrust into the heart of the Reich. The British wanted to attack through the north of Germany, while the Americans proposed their assault should penetrate further south and strike for the Nazi heartland. Both the British and American generals believed that if their strategy was the one implemented, then the war could be over by the end of October 1944. The Allied Supreme Commander, examining the alternative strategies for the invasion of Germany, could clearly see the benefits of each. The broad advance would need many weeks for the exhausted armies to recover and resupply, but it did have the advantage of producing a certain outcome. The alternative narrow thrust although it would have a much less predictable result, could be mounted immediately. An immediate narrow thrust that could soon end the war was a highly attractive proposition. But political considerations weighed against such a move. Anglo-American relations were strained enough without allowing one ally to reap all the glory. It was decided to maintain the original strategy of a broad front advance and complete the resupplying of the armies before beginning the final assault. Hitler and his senior Wehrmacht officers understood clearly that the only possible hope the Reich had for avoiding defeat was to undermine and destroy the alliance formed against them. The Germans planned to effect this with a combination of all-out counterattacks, deadly new revenge weapons, and fortified fixed defenses. To demoralize the American forces still further, German intelligence used cleverly targeted propaganda. Leaflets and radio broadcasts continually told the American GIs that while they were doing all the fighting, the British were resting in the quiet sectors, saving their own lives at American expense. If the Allies did manage to penetrate as far as the German frontier, they would meet formidable fixed defenses. Even before the outbreak of war, the Third Reich had begun fortifying its borders. The West Wall, better known to the Allies as the Siegfried Line, was a series of fortifications stretching all along the German boundary with France. It was made up of pillboxes, anti-tank obstacles, and mines. But since the Germans had banked on halting the Allies in Normandy, the West Wall had been allowed to decay. In the autumn of 1944, it was hastily improved and reinforced. And although most of the reinforcements were youths and old men, they would be extremely well armed. The Ruhr, Germany's industrial heartland, lay less than 50 miles from the Reich's border. The Ruhr's main protection was the West Wall, or Siegfried Line, 3 miles deep and running from the southern border all the way to Holland. Before the Allies could enter the Ruhr, they would have to cross several natural barriers, one of the greatest being the River Ruhr. The Ruhr was dammed in 7 places, and the largest dam, the Schwammenoil, was 180 feet high. These dams could be opened by German engineers at any time, making the river totally impassable, or cutting off any enemy forces that had already crossed. 25 miles east of the Ruhr was the River Rhine, one of the largest and fastest flowing rivers in Europe. All the Rhine's bridges had been primed with explosives to be detonated when the Allies were just a few miles away, making an Allied forced crossing extremely hazardous. The German soldiers defending the Reich were under strict orders never to give ground. But if forced to withdraw, they were to leave nothing intact for the Allies. Every single bridge and every vehicle that could not be taken away was to be destroyed. The Germans had to make the assault on the Reich as difficult and as costly as possible. Every day that the war was prolonged was another day for the alliance to break and for the Germans to wrench victory from the jaws of defeat. We'll be right back. General Dwight Eisenhower became the supreme commander of the Allied Expeditionary Force in January 1944, promoted over 100 more senior generals. Eisenhower had a difficult dual task as supreme commander: to liaise with senior politicians and to lead an Allied army made up from a great many different nations. However, Eisenhower had extraordinary political and diplomatic abilities that would be of priceless value in leading the campaign ahead. Eisenhower was greatly admired by Roosevelt, who considered him one of the most able commanders in the United States Army, and he was on excellent terms with Prime Minister Churchill. Eisenhower had spent more than a year in England, where he had grown to love and be loved by the British people. As a result, he was very sympathetic to Britain's particular needs and problems. However, Eisenhower's close relationship with the British was occasionally prone to irritate Roosevelt, who, distancing himself more and more from Great Britain, felt that the official chain of command was being too frequently bypassed. The growing Anglo-American rift that Eisenhower had to contend with at the political level was nothing compared to the outright hostility between several military commanders. In particular, there was open rivalry between two of Eisenhower's most famous subordinates. The British Field Marshal Montgomery was a single-minded and determined commander and had led all Allied ground forces during the Battle for Normandy. As a result, he considered himself to be Eisenhower's number two. But by early September, the American General Bradley was equal in rank. However, Bradley had few concerns other than to defeat Germany. And it was his brilliant spearhead commander, General George Patton, who became Montgomery's main challenger for glory. The contest between Patton and Montgomery to become the greatest Allied general would shake the Western Alliance to the very core and test to the limit even the diplomatic talents of General Eisenhower. In 1939, Gert von Rundstedt had been brought out of retirement to command Army Group A for the invasion of Poland. Rundstedt fought a brilliant campaign, and in 1940, his forces helped conquer the French in just 6 weeks. Over the next 4 years, Rundstedt went on to fight successfully on the Eastern Front and in Italy, and never once lost a battle. In January 1944, Rundstedt was given command of the Wehrmacht in the West, with orders to deny the Allies a foothold on French territory. But by the end of June 1944, in the face of total Allied air superiority, it was clear that Rundstedt had failed. Hitler had continuously interfered and had not even allowed him to commit his reserves to battle without permission. Hitler accused von Rundstedt of being a defeatist and dismissed him at the end of the month. Rundstedt had resigned himself to the third retirement of his career when, 2 months later, he was suddenly recalled. In July 1944, a bomb had been planted by army officers in Hitler's headquarters. Von Rundstedt's successor had been implicated and committed suicide. Hitler now had a deep mistrust of all Wehrmacht commanders, and knew that although Rundstedt was a defeatist, he was at least loyal. On September the 5th, 1944, Rundstedt once more became commander-in-chief of all Wehrmacht forces in the West. Field Marshal von Rundstedt was now 69 years old, and he had been in the army for 52 years. Many Wehrmacht officers believed he was tired and worn out, bringing nothing but despondency to the vital task of defending the Reich's frontier. Rundstedt knew he faced an extremely dangerous situation and was sure he would be defeated in the end. Nevertheless, he immediately began regrouping his forces and reinforcing the weakest sectors of the Western Front. Allied advance from June to September 1944 had been achieved more rapidly than the planners had anticipated. And now, the greatest single threat to continued Allied success was from overextended supply lines. Each infantry division required 20,000 tons daily, all of which still came from Normandy. Every effort was being made to ensure the Allied spearheads were given the fuel and ammunition they needed. The most important was Operation Pluto, the laying of a series of pipelines under the sea, which directly connected Britain and France. The coils, weighing more than a destroyer, could reel out 70 miles of pipe. Once connected to the mainland, pipelines were laid all the way across France to the Allied front. In preparation for the D-Day landings, the United States Air Force and Britain's Royal Air Force had dropped thousands of tons of high explosives on Wehrmacht road, rail, and communication networks. Now that the ground forces were well established on French soil, the air forces could return the bombers to their original task of pulverizing German industry. Senior Air Force commanders believed that their efforts to destroy the Ruhr industry might yet produce the total collapse of Germany without the need for an actual invasion. As the liberation of France had progressed, the number of targets for the air forces had steadily diminished. This meant that ever greater numbers of aircraft could be concentrated against an ever-decreasing number of targets. The P-38 Lightning was designed in 1936 as a high-altitude interceptor. Built by Lockheed, it was the company's very first military design. The distinctive twin-boomed Lightning first flew in 1939, when its top speed of 400 miles per hour was exceptional. The Lightning, armed with four machine guns in the nose, first saw combat in Europe in August 1941. And became the first American fighter to destroy a German aircraft. The P-38 was incredibly versatile and operated successfully in all Allied theaters. As well as being a high-altitude interceptor, the Lightning's high speed would prove valuable in photo reconnaissance, as a long-range escort, and as a ground attack aircraft, often armed with 14 rockets. The Lightning was known to the Germans as the Forked-Tailed Devil and became the only American fighter to remain in production throughout the entire war. The M4 medium tank, known to the British as the Sherman, was the standard Allied tank of World War II. As a result of neglect in engine development before the war, the designers had used an aviation engine, which gave the Sherman its distinctive high profile. This made the Sherman an easier target than many of its contemporaries. However, the Sherman was simple, easy to maintain, and highly adaptable. And by late 1944, over 40,000 had been produced. The Willis MB General Purpose or GP Utility Vehicle was known to Allied troops as the Jeep. The Jeep had a 4x4 transmission, which enabled it to negotiate rough terrain and reach up to 65 miles per hour on the open road. The Jeep was most highly prized as a forward reconnaissance vehicle for the main armored spearheads, but it was a versatile machine. It was used extensively as a field ambulance and as VIP transport. for amphibious operations in all theatres, the jeep had been fitted with an extended vertical exhaust pipe, so it could drive from landing craft to beach without flooding the engine. This capability would be extremely valuable in crossing the multitude of rivers and canals protecting Germany's border. By the end of the war, an incredible 400,000 jeeps would have been built. The Avro Lancaster was designed in 1940 and took its first flight in early 1941. It was powered by four Rolls-Royce Merlin engines, the same engine fitted in the Spitfire fighter. The Lancaster was extremely fast and had excellent maneuverability. It was armed with 10 machine guns in four hydraulically operated turrets and had one of the biggest bomb bays of any aircraft. It entered service with the RAF in 1942, and by the end of the war, more than 7,000 would have been built. The Lancaster was easily adapted for a number of specialist roles. Modified Lancasters carried bouncing bombs used to destroy Germany's dams. Later in the battle, the Lancaster was the only bomber capable of carrying the massive 22,000-pound Grand Slam demolition bomb. As the mainstay of the RAF's strategic bombing effort, the Lancaster would drop 600,000 tons of bombs, more than two-thirds of the total tonnage dropped by the RAF in World War II.
Sunday's Discovery Showcase brings you the arid hot.
At its peak, the German army had more than 200 full-strength divisions in the field. But 5.5 years of continual conflict had steadily taken a toll on the Wehrmacht's fighting capability. By September 1944, most of the remaining 224 divisions were merely fragments of the original formations. In Western Europe, since the Allies had landed in Normandy, the Wehrmacht had lost more than 2,000 armored vehicles. Less than 100 had managed to escape from France. The German army's communication networks had also been badly hit by Allied bombing, and its supply levels had been greatly reduced. However, the remnants of the Wehrmacht were now close to, or actually in, Germany. This meant they were not just nearer to headquarters, which allowed improved coordination, but also their supply lines were much shorter, enabling faster deployment of replacements and reserves. Over the last few years, German production of armor and aircraft had been severely disrupted by the Allied strategic bombing offensive. However, in the first half of 1944, the Allies had switched the bombing offensive to transport and communication targets in France in preparation for D-Day. And German industry had made a rapid recovery. It even surpassed previous output. However, after June, production dropped off rapidly as factories and raw materials fell to the Allied advance, and the Allied bombers returned to pound German industry. As weapons stock fell, the problem for the army was compounded by the Nazi leadership, which equipped raw replacement units with the best, while starving veteran divisions of weapons and ammunition. By the autumn of 1944, the Luftwaffe had surrendered control of the skies to the Allied air forces. On D-Day, it had only managed 250 sorties, compared to 14,000 by the Allies. Over the next few months, although it was equipped with advanced aircraft, it could do little but fight a delaying action. Nevertheless, the Luftwaffe fighters would continue to rip into Allied bombing formations until their airfields were captured by the advancing Allied armies, or until they were grounded by fuel shortages. The Panzer Mark V, or Panther, was designed in 1942 in response to the vastly superior performance of Soviet tanks. Throughout its first production run, the Panther was plagued by specification changes, and its weight increased by 9 tons. The extra weight had a detrimental effect on many of its original components, and the Panther would prove very unreliable, needing a great deal of maintenance. The Panther was fitted with a new, high-velocity 75mm gun, which with smaller and lighter shells still had better armor-piercing capabilities than most other tanks. The excellent gun, combined with good maneuverability and heavy armor, made the Panther far superior to any British or American tank. The Focke Wulf 190 was designed in 1938 to be the main Luftwaffe fighter. Its greatest asset was its extremely powerful BMW radial engine. The 190 was one of the fastest piston-engined aircraft ever to fly. It was sleek and highly maneuverable, and by the end of the war, 20,000 would have been produced. When the 190 first saw combat in 1941, it quickly proved itself superior to all Allied fighters. It was smaller, faster, more maneuverable, and was also heavily armed with 2 cannons and 2 machine guns. The 190 was continually improved, and in late 1944, the final version would be one of the greatest fighters of the war. The Messerschmitt 262 was the world's first operational jet fighter. The 262 could reach a speed of 525 miles per hour, making it by far the fastest combat aircraft of the entire war. It was well armed with 4 nose cannons. Extremely responsive and excellent to fly, its high cockpit giving the pilot exceptionally good views. Although 262s were cheap to build, there were severe shortages of the metals needed for the jet turbine blades. Even worse, the engines themselves were dangerously unreliable and had a lifespan of just 25 hours. Although 1,500 262s would enter service, even that number could not affect the outcome of the war. And in any case, fuel shortages severely limited operations. However, when the 262 did see action, it was the deadliest aircraft over the battlefield. The V-2 rocket was designed as long-range artillery and was one of the greatest single advances ever made in weapons technology. The rocket began development in 1936 at Peenemünde in North Germany, and extensive testing took place throughout the 1930s. At launch, the V-2 weighed 13.5 tons, and it was driven by a powerful alcohol and liquid oxygen motor. The rocket was guided by a gyroscopic system, that placed it on a ballistic trajectory. It carried enough fuel for 1 minute of thrust, at which point the engine cut out and the rocket plunged silently towards the Earth. The V-2 had a 350-mile range, and its one-ton explosive head would strike its target at an unprecedented 3,800 miles per hour. By the end of the war, nearly 6,000 V-2 rockets would have been produced. They could be launched from mobile sites or from fixed batteries, and more than 2,500 would fall on British and continental cities. After liberating Brussels on the 3rd of September 1944, the British Army raced immediately for Antwerp, the second largest port in Europe. The capture of Antwerp was essential if the Allies were to build up the gigantic amount of supplies needed to launch the invasion of Germany. Although the British 11th Armored Division liberated Antwerp on the 4th of September, the Germans held several islands in the estuary near to the city. Until these German strongholds were destroyed, the Allies would be unable to use the river and the port would remain closed. In the second week of September, with Antwerp unlikely to be operational in the immediate future, the British proposed an imaginative plan to cross the Rhine without delay. To head off American protests, it was a modified version of their original plan. A compromise, which would not use up all the available supplies. Codenamed Market Garden, it would be mounted without the need for a massive and time-consuming build-up of supplies. Not only this, Market Garden would also outflank Germany's Siegfried Line. On September the 10th, Eisenhower gave Market Garden the green light. Montgomery had just 7 days to finalize plans for the largest airborne offensive in history.